Remember, click before you dig. It's the law. For more information, visit utilitieskingston.com.
It's 5 p.m. on a Monday, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from Kingston, Ontario. Coming up next, today in YGK.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by your CFRC News Collective, Ara McCauley, Jesse Bell, and Jenny Hinch. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Ara McCauley, and here are your local news headlines. As wildfires continue to spread across Canada and eastern Ontario recovers from last month's prolonged smoke-related poor air quality effects, a newly released report from World Weather Attribution, a team of researchers from several institutions including the Center for Environmental Policy and the Red Cross Red Crescent Climate Center, is highlighting the impact of climate change on Canada's environment, safety, and health. The group is raising the alarm over the fact that across Canada, approximately 94% of the total area burned this season occurred during a five-week period between the end of June and end of July, fueled by extreme heat, dry conditions, and strong winds, with further fires sparked by lightning storms. Although the 2026 wildfire season, which starts on April 1st in Ontario, began slow, above-average temperatures and dry weather in late June and through July has resulted in 687 fires to date, already a 55% increase over 2025, which saw 442 wildfires, and well above the 10-year average of 481 fires in the province. Extreme heat is a growing concern, and the City of Kingston declared July 15th Extreme Heat Awareness Day this year after a proposal from a local chapter of Seniors for Climate Action Now brought further attention to the issue locally. According to the Canadian Wildland Fire Information System, nearly 3.9 million hectares of wildland have burned during this year's wildfire season, prompting the Government of Canada to institute National Preparedness Level 4, indicating wildland fire behavior is significant, the demand for resources is high through the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center, and the potential for emerging significant wildland fires is expected to continue or increase the demand on resources. While the KFLNA region has experienced relief from the significant smoke experienced last month, forecasts caution that another warm, dry spell is on the horizon, meaning the potential for more wildfire smoke making its way to Kingston is still high. The World Weather Attribution worked with scientists from Canada, the US, and Europe to complete the report, which also highlighted the disproportionate impact of fires on Indigenous communities, who tend to be overrepresented in wildfire areas and often situated in remote communities, which makes evacuation more challenging. The threat of wildfire and the need to evacuate has both physical and mental health impacts on those living in threatened areas, while devastation of forest area disrupts access to hunting grounds and areas of cultural significance. Even in more urban areas, the threat of fire to properties and to public health is high, especially as resources are stretched thin. Smoke from the fires can travel over hundreds of kilometers and cause severe and often delayed health impacts. According to the WWA report, exposure to elevated concentrations of wildfire smoke has been associated with increased emergency healthcare use, particularly from respiratory and cardiovascular conditions, ranging from difficulty breathing to cardiac arrest, as well as increases in all-cause mortality. The report points to human-induced climate change, saying it has increased both the likelihood and intensity of the weather conditions at the time of fires. Research in 2023 found that Quebec's severe start to the fire season was made 7 times more likely due to human-caused climate change, and the WWA states that a growing body of peer-reviewed research research has established that climate change is driving the increasing severity of extreme Canadian fire seasons, with a 1.4 degree increase in temperature making the likelihood of rapidly developing and spreading fires 3.5 times more likely. The report encourages Canada to sustain an effective response through the remainder of the fire season through interagency coordination, flexible deployment of personnel and equipment across jurisdictions, and ensuring sufficient surge capacity to respond to new large fires without compromising ongoing operations. Looking forward, they recommend an integrated risk management approach, including incorporating future fire risk into timber harvest allocations and improving forest resilience after fires occur by diversifying with less flammable tree species. 137 fires are active in northeast and northwest Ontario as of today, with 18 forest fires in northwest Ontario considered not under control at this time. Across Canada, 638 fires are now active, with 124 deemed out of control. The Southeast Public Health Region suggests the following advice to protect yourself during poor air quality events. Everyone is at risk for health impacts related to poor air quality. However, health risks are greatest for infants and children, older adults, those living in high air pollution areas, people living with chronic illnesses such as asthma, diabetes, heart or lung diseases, people who are pregnant, people who are underhoused or experiencing homelessness, people who work outdoors, or people participating in strenuous sports and outdoor activities. If you are experiencing symptoms such as increased coughing, throat irritation, headaches, or shortness of breath, consider reducing or rescheduling strenuous outdoor activity until the air quality improves. As smoke levels rise, so do health risks. Take protective measures to protect yourself and others from the effects of wildfire smoke. Reduce or reschedule strenuous activities outdoors, especially if you experience symptoms such as coughing and throat irritation. When indoors, keep windows and doors closed as much as possible. Protect your indoor air from wildfire smoke by using a clean, high-quality air filter in your ventilation system and/or a certified portable air cleaner that can filter fine particles. If you must spend time outdoors, a well-fitting NIOSH-certified N95 respirator or equivalent may help reduce your exposure to harmful fine particles. Masks can reduce your exposure to the fine particles in smoke, but do not reduce exposure to gases. Watch for symptoms of smoke exposure. Mild and common symptoms of smoke exposure include sore and watery eyes, runny nose and sinus irritation, scratchy throat and mild coughing, and headache. Severe symptoms of smoke exposure include shortness of breath, wheezing, including asthma attacks, severe coughing, dizziness, chest pains, and heart palpitations. Seek medical attention if you develop severe symptoms. The City of Kingston is reminding Kingston residents interested in municipal office to file nominations before the August 21st deadline. Kingston voters will elect a mayor, district councillors, and school board trustees on Monday, October 26, 2026. Candidate nominations will close at 2 p.m. on Friday, August 21st. The city encourages potential candidates to book an appointment to file nomination papers to ensure time and staff are available to complete the process. To qualify as a candidate, you must be a Canadian citizen, be at least 18 years of age, live in Kingston or own or rent property in Kingston, or be married to someone who does, and not be prevented from voting by any law. Individuals interested in running for office can find information about nominations requirements, candidate responsibilities, and important dates on Get Involved Kingston or at cityofkingston.ca/election. All residents are also encouraged to visit registertovoteon.ca before August 12th to confirm, update, or add your name to the voters list in advance of the 2026 municipal election. Starting in September, residents will be able to do so on the city website, and registering as soon as possible will ensure you are ballot ready. That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Jesse Bell with your CFRC Sports Desk.
This is part 8 of your OUA football season preview, brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. Today we'll be discussing the Guelph Griffins, an immensely talented team that struggled to stay healthy in 2025. They kind of reminded me of the 2024 Queens Gaels, and by that I mean it's an exciting team with high expectations that were undone by bad luck,
but not before tallying a wild upset on the road against an imposing opponent. Guelph with Western, Queens in 2024 with Windsor. Now in 2025, Guelph had all the tools they needed to succeed. They played Laurier tight in week 1, got overwhelmed by Western in week 2, and then bounced back to beat Windsor in week 3. They lost a close one to Ottawa, and then they were blindsided by one of the biggest upsets of the year as they lost to McMaster on the road to drop to 1-4. I had Guelph finishing 6-2 in 2025, and here they are at 1-4, but they would rebound to beat Carleton thanks to a 4-interception day from defensive back Gianni Green before falling to Queens at their own homecoming. So Guelph, they are 2-5. They are on the outside looking in, and they would have to beat a scrappy York team to make the playoffs, where they would, 1 week later, shock the world on the road with an 18-17 victory over Western, knocking the Mustangs out of the OUA playoffs in the quarterfinals. Guelph would nearly repeat this feat the following week against Laurier with a frantic final quarter comeback that ended about 50 yards short. It is probably the most eventful 4-6 season ever. Let's take a look at their 2025 stats. They were 4th in points for with 236, that is 29.5 points per game. They were 4th in total yards with 3,723, which is about 493 yards per game. They were, surprisingly, 7th in total passing yards with 2,327, but 2nd in total rushing yards with 1,618, which is about 202 yards per game. So this passing offense, which I thought was going to be one of the best in the country, I think due to injuries, they could never just fully get rolling. The defense finished 6th in total points allowed with 240, which is about 30 points per game. They finished 5th in pass yards allowed per game with 289.9, and 2nd in rush yards per game with 133.8, 5th overall in total yards per game with 423.6. So kind of a middling defense in terms of points allowed, but an excellent unit against the run and pass. But you may have noticed, they gave up more points per game than they scored, which means they actually had a negative point differential of -4, which puts them at 6th in the conference. This is what I'm saying, what a bizarre season. This is a team that, at times, was fantastic, nearly knocked off Laurier a week after knocking off Western, and they did so with a negative point differential. This is kind of reflective of their last 5 seasons in general. In 2021, they went 3-3, but they beat Western in the regular season. In 2022, they had one of the most random 1-7 seasons ever, completely bottoming out. 2023, they build a bit of momentum, finish 3-5. 2024, they go 6-2, they look great. And then 2025, they swing back down to 3-5 and just narrowly, barely, by the skin of their teeth, make it into the playoffs. So what do we expect in 2026? Honestly, who knows? It's boom or bust. Guelph does have a lot of returning playmakers. They lost a ton of experienced guys from the offensive line. They still have 2 great quarterbacks in Tristan Abood and Marshall McRae. Abood, more of your traditional pocket passer, and McRae, a great dual threat player. But McRae was used in the slot during the East-West Bowl, and he looked great. So he may not be playing quarterback in 2026. He might be a gadget guy. It might be like how they use Russell Weir on the Queens offense. Now, if Guelph can stay healthy, they will be dangerous. Their defense has great athletes, and for the most part, played up to the potential last year. Their special teams unit struggled, especially in comparison to years past. They had a rookie kicker from Kingston, Trey Thompson, who missed some big kicks, but also was responsible for the Rouge that beat Western. Like I said, boom or bust. Now Guelph, they do have a fairly light schedule in 2026. They have a very interesting week 1 game against the new look Laurier Golden Hawks. After that, they've got 5 winnable games against McMaster, Carleton, Ottawa, Waterloo, and Toronto, before closing up the season with slugfests against Queens and Windsor. Now I've got Guelph going 6-2, with their only losses coming at the tail end of the season to the Gales and the Lancers. I think they're going to be a top 4 team in 2026. But just bear in mind, I also thought that was going to be the case in 2025, and once again, they finished 3-5 and just barely got into the playoffs. So with Guelph, I really truly could not give you a great read on what's going on, but I think it's going to be a lot of fun to watch them.
That's a wrap for your sports report. Coming up next, I've got your traffic and weather reports for the city of Kingston. This is your City of Kingston traffic report. Cranbrook Street from Lakeview Avenue to Days Road is closed for pedestrian improvements. Bath Road from Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard to Portsmouth Avenue. Expect delays for the installation of intersection pedestrian signals. The city is installing these IPS at the following intersections: Bath Road at LaFleur Park, Concession Street at Kings Court Avenue, and Stephen Street at Patrick Street. Wright Crescent at Palace Road to Palace Road. Closed for a contractor to complete roadway repairs, pedestrian safety and access improvements, and traffic common features on Wright Crescent. Norman Rogers Drive from Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard to Van Order Drive started on June 15th, and Norman Rogers Drive is still closed to through traffic to facilitate roadway rehabilitation and configuration improvements. This work will improve road condition, accessibility, and safety for all road users. The City of Kingston and Utilities Kingston are in the midst of a major reconstruction of Princess Street. This infrastructure project includes upgrades to underground and above ground utilities, as well as improvements to enhance safety and comfort for pedestrian and cyclists. Berry Street from Queen is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street, and Aberdeen Street from Johnson to William is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with Monday, August 10th. 24 is your high, with an 88% chance of precipitation, including a high likelihood of an afternoon thunderstorm. Tuesday, August 11th. 24 is your high, feeling closer to 28, quite humid, and a UV index of 8 with a 55% chance of rain, but just a quick shower, right around 1 millimeter or so. Wednesday, August 12th, 24 is your high with a 49% chance of precipitation, mix of sun and cloud, feeling closer to 27. Thursday, August 13th, 24 is your high with a 71% chance of precipitation, about a millimeter and a half all told. Friday, August 14th, 24 degrees is your high, mix of sun and cloud, otherwise a beautiful day here in the City of Kingston. And then kicking off the weekend, Saturday, August 15th, 22 is your high, feeling closer to 25, but quite a cloudy day here in the City of Kingston, UV index of 6. Sunday, August 16th, 23 is your high, with a chance of precipitation throughout the day, mostly in the mid-morning, about 2.5 millimeters of rain altogether. Monday, August 17th, 23 is your high, feeling closer to 24, clouds with periods of sunshine, otherwise a beautiful day. That's a wrap for sports, traffic, and weather. Coming up next, we have Genevieve Hinch with CFRC's concert and events calendar.
Hello, Kingston, and welcome back to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario, I'm CFRC's Community News and Arts Coordinator, Jenny, and this is your weekly events and concerts calendar brought to you by Flying V Productions. Whether you're looking for live music, community events, markets, workshops, or something fun to do around the city, there is lots happening this week, so let's get into it. Starting off Monday, grab lunch at Café Franglais and get creative at Craft and Create at the Central Library. Or test your knowledge at Trivia Night at Something in the Water. Live music includes Natalie and Dave at the RCHA Club, The Lucky Ones at the Cove Inn, the Cataraqui Chamber Music Festival at the Sphere, and the Mourning Doves at Musiki. On Tuesday, get moving with Chair Fitness and check out the ASL Workshop, catch Nuts at the Tet Center, or dance the evening away at Salsa in the Square. Live music includes the Cataraqui Chamber Music Festival, Tom Savage at the RCHA Club, Brian Brin and Gary Finn at the Cove Inn, and Ricky Brandt's open mic at Musiki. Wednesday features games in the square, swinging summer at the City Hall Amphitheater, trivia, karaoke, euchre, Eunice Verse's third solo drag show. Live music includes Taryn McKenna, Vince DeBeal, Sean McCullen, Quentin Cotree, Christopher Jackson, Wayne Riley's open mic, and lots more happening Wednesday. On Thursday, browse the Kingston Public Market, bring the kids to Stories in the Square, get creative with Bring Your Own Craft or the Felt Mushroom Craft, or catch the Peanuts movie in Springer Market Square. There's also Queen's Family Night, Trivia, and Drag Bingo. Live music includes Grevin and Allie McCormick, Bentley McKegney, J.S. Miller, the Luke Vassar Trio, Jeff Dunn, and the Friendly Frogs Freak Show with the Ratskin Family Band. Friday includes Spanish conversation sessions, a scrapbook and cards class at the Tet Center, Kicking It Country, and karaoke. Music highlights include The Smoking Roosters, Mellow Lily, Deadroot Revival, and the Cataraqui Chamber Music Festival. Heading into Saturday, check out the Kingston Public Market, Farm Fair, the Mini Market Series, Chef Demos, the Ironwood Fantasy Fair, Saturday Session, or Refuel at Cultivate Art Commons. Live music includes the Oscar Evans Bands, Music Westport, Three's Company, John McClurg, Rivercat, Squid Pistol, Thomas Draper, and Jessica Wolowicz, Sweet Cheetah, Powderfinger, The Oreos, and Jake Toes. Wrapping things up Sunday, head to the Memorial Center Farmers Market, Yoga in Battery Park, Jazz Brunch at Black Dog, or the Summer BBQ and Bocce at the Italo-Canadian Club. Music includes the Back to the Farm Beer and Music Festival, Head Over Heels, Chantel Thompson, Wayne Riley, and live band karaoke with the Oreos. That is your weekly events and concerts calendar for August 10th through the 16th. For more information on any of these events, visit the CFRC website and keep it locked right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. This events calendar is brought to you by Flying V Productions, bringing live theater, comedy, and unforgettable entertainment to audiences all across Kingston. I'm Jenny. Thanks for listening and have a great week, Kingston.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and listen on the go, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
After 9 long months, Gales Game Day makes its triumphant return to CFRC.
Queens Gales are golden once more.
Tune in on Sunday, August 30th at 6:45 p.m. to catch all the action that makes you stand up and say,
OMG!
This is Canada's most exhilarating sports broadcast.
And it's picked off, picked off, picked off.
This is Canada's gold standard of football action.
The Gales stop the Griffins short.
This is Gales Game Day.
Running hard, breaking away. Touchdown, Queens.
And it can only be found on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection from Port of Montreal, the debut album by Kingston-based rap duo D98, consisting of rapper Dupel and rapper-producer N98, who joined us a few weeks ago to chat about their work here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Born from the long nights traveling on the 401, long days spent exploring the architecture of Montreal and intense studio sessions, the new album is the ultimate reflection of D98 as people. Flashy, raw, and endlessly creative, this album has a lineup of great featured artists including Jordan, Mercules, Kakao, Wilhound, and Nolan Hubbard. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Port of Montreal by D98 on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it here called Swishers with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Start to feel like I'm Drake. Whole team going crazy cause we hard to ignore. Cameras flashing on a fit soon as I walk through the door. They keep asking why the fuck is Mark so confident for? I can't hear him from the top floor and honestly, you're, yeah. I swear to God, most of these rappers are clueless. We had to make it out the mud and then we branded this movement. It's Big Merc. Death Row Records in this bitch, ho.
I ain't got time for ya. None of your homies is dying for ya.
Someone's in crest on my tombstone.
None of your women is lying for ya.
Shorty been riding since days we had nothing.
I been broken, she been right there, brother.
You pay, still ain't coming. Pay to play songs, they still ain't bumping.
North Star goals, Polaris the watch. Giving them hell, Hieronymus Bosch. For Grammy, we be moving for Junos. Y'all moving weird, blowing up your own spot.
Y'all really jealous of what we done got? What was your name, bitch? I almost forgot. D98 hoes, Nathan and Shock.
How do I know I've been knowing? Y'all had enough, we really be poet. Dragging on switches, we dip for them homing. And die for our homies, it's heaven for stoners. Sometimes it's hell in the city of stone. Shout out to my brothers who sell on the corner. None of y'all haters gon' get it, so get MTLYG, keep bringing it home. I know I've been knowing. Y'all had enough, we really be poet. Dragging on switches, we live for the moment. And die for our homies, it's heaven for stoners.
Ride or die for my crew. Why would I change who I am just to prove? None of y'all haters gon' get it, so fuck it. MTLYG, keep making our moves. We'll be right back.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 329. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with researcher Alex Nelson, who's based in London, Ontario, Canada, at Western University. And I spoke to Alex, I think, about a very important topic in regards to understanding the nature of the housing crisis today in Canada. Often, mainstream media narratives really paint either super individualized portraits of, you know, at times people experiencing injustice in relation to housing precarity, but also that type of reporting, I think, removes an understanding of the sort of connections and common points of experience between the ways that housing precarity is tied to systemic issues like the financialization of housing. This was a chance to speak with somebody who's really invested in pushing for housing advocacy and research work that is directly tied to those who have experienced housing precarity themselves. I just wanted to share this conversation. It's coming out of work that I've been doing here on the program, but also more broadly to document and lift up voices involved in housing justice work. You can learn more about that at housingjustice.now. But here is my conversation with researcher Alex Nelson on the collective nature of housing crisis points in Canada today on this week's edition of Free City Radio. There's an acknowledgement in Canada of there being a profound housing crisis. This is spoken about openly across the political spectrum. And that point of acknowledgement is relatively new. The sort of point of distance between a lot of the ways that this crisis is being addressed in terms of political language and, you know, sort of thinking about or thinking through alternatives to this very intense reality that many people are experiencing in relation to the housing crisis is sort of how do you involve people who are facing it? You know, and Alex, your research kind of looks at this question. It seems that often when there's quote unquote solutions proposed, that there's not a lot of process that actually involves communities that are experiencing housing precarity or, you know, facing being without a home. So maybe we could start with an introduction, but also some of your reflections on from your vantage point as a researcher at Western University, how some of the work that you've done with community organizations sort of speak to that importance of a more ground-up approach that centers the experience of people who are dealing with these questions directly.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to start by saying, locating myself as a person with lived experience of homelessness, it's really important to me to explain that my own firsthand experiences shape the way that I think about why lived experience is so important, especially because in my own history and story and way of experiencing the housing system, there have been these points of disconnection between what I knew to be true and saw firsthand and the kind of dominant stories that are told about what homelessness is, how it happens, what it looks like, what it feels like. And so I always knew that there was something that I wanted to do with those stories and also that kind of knowledge from the ground up. And so that's really important to me to kind of name from the beginning, because it's other people who have those direct experiences, who I'm in community with, who have helped me gain the knowledge that I have. And so that kind of lineage of knowledge sharing is so vital in addressing the housing crisis and to say, you know, there's profound knowledge about some of these disconnects that exist within communities that are facing these issues firsthand. And the answers already exist. I think knowing that in communities across the country, there is such a profound need around housing, and the solutions that are being proposed and being forwarded really don't always fundamentally address some of the underlying issues that lead to homelessness in the first place. Issues like colonization, issues like white supremacy, homophobia, transphobia, things that uproot people from their homes and cause fractures and magnify fractures in society. And I think the solutions that we need to put forward need to grapple with these things directly.
Thanks for sharing that, Alex, and sort of giving a sense of where you're coming from. Maybe it would be interesting first to start by any thoughts you have about the way that the current government in Canada is addressing this question, because there is a lot of talk about the housing crisis and the need to build homes, et cetera, and sort of offering a sort of deeper sense of some of the limitations of the policy that exists. And maybe just also highlight some examples of like organizations or processes that you've been connected to that you feel would be important to listen to in a context like the one that we're in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I've seen, and I'm not sure there are necessarily structures in place to address directly, is the financialization of housing. In Canada, through the National Housing Strategy Act of 2019, there were human rights mechanisms that were introduced to help alleviate homelessness and address housing rights issues across the country. The first review panel launched in connection with the National Housing Strategy Act was addressing this issue of the financialization of housing, which is essentially, you know, housing being primarily seen as a tool to generate profit and not as a human right. And those ideas of what housing is and what it should be are often in conflict. And so when I hear things like, you know, we need to focus on supply, we need to focus on building homes, that doesn't necessarily mean that people will be able to have the resources to afford those homes. And often, even if homes exist, people are not able to access them with the resources that they have. I think that these deep issues of unaffordability aren't really meaning that homelessness is being alleviated. And I know that not being able to afford housing is really pressing concern for people living in Canada, some communities being impacted more directly and more deeply than others. There was a rental market report that came out within the last few years that showed that in some communities like Toronto, Victoria, several others, the availability of housing that's affordable to the lowest income earners in Canada is statistically zero, which means that even if housing's created, often it's going to be housing that meets the needs of people who already have those resources to afford it. And so people are kind of pushed out the bottom of the market in a way that makes issues around housing so much deeper and so much worse. And so there are organizations working at a national level to help address some of these issues and are helping to kind of shed light on some of the stories that are undertold. One of the issues that I also work around is housing rights for 2SLGBTQ plus people and gender diverse people specifically. So transgender, non-binary, two-spirit folks, because the housing system is also set up in a way that often excludes or reinforces discrimination or doesn't protect or affirm people who are not cisgender. And that kind of dovetails with some of these anti-trans sentiments that are becoming increasingly more prevalent in this country. One organization that I've worked with over the last several years working on this issue is the Women's National Housing and Homelessness Network. They do a lot of advocacy around gender-based responses to the housing crisis and do a lot of research that I think is shifting narratives around housing and homelessness and allowing different possibilities for stories to be told. Research that I supported with the Women's National Housing and Homelessness Network a few years ago, for example, it was research that involved surveys of over 500 women, girls, and gender diverse people showed that for the majority of respondents, people's most recent experience of homelessness was due to the breakup of a romantic relationship. That is not part of the story that gets told around homelessness in Canada. And I think that when we're thinking about, you know, how do we address housing need, housing precarity, homelessness amongst different communities, different types of people, we need to be thinking outside of, you know, the box that is the standard, the norm, because so many people are becoming homeless for reasons that are not addressed effectively by policy.
So you touched on a number of points there, Alex. Thank you. I wanted to go back to a key issue that you addressed, which is the financialization of housing and sort of the, you know, there's a lot of layers to that. And you mentioned earlier the importance of understanding you know, sort of the connections between the housing crisis and continued patterns of colonization and sort of how, like, quote unquote, home ownership enforces this conception of ownership over territory, which on its sort of territorial basis in Canada is rooted in the displacement of Indigenous people, A, and B, it sort of enforces this idea that the only sort of possibility of any wealth generation is based in a very sort of individualistic or family bubble, as opposed to thinking through what could collective wealth be or a housing reality that's not based on financialization. So maybe we could just zero in a bit more on thinking through this problematic of financialization, because I find that in a lot of mainstream reporting about the housing crisis, this is not broken down, right? Whether it's the sort of like investment firms buying up low-income housing and then slowly displacing communities, as we saw in the Herongate community in Ottawa. There's many other examples. So yeah, I'd love to hear a bit more about your reflections on the importance of sort of decoding and the importance of that, of this sort of financialization of housing and how that's really part of the crisis we're facing.
I am really interested in the work of Ricardo Tranjan and his book, The Tenant Class. And in that book, he offers this really important idea, which is, you know, we really need to be critical of this concept of the housing crisis, because the word crisis suggests that this is, you know, accidental, or that the reason we're here is because it's outside of people's control. And in fact, the way that the system is organized generates massive profits for investors, for corporations, for large-scale landlords, and they benefit materially from the way the system is organized. And so displacement of communities through eviction, like in the case of Herongate, or in other situations where people's needs to have housing are prioritized as lower than the pathway to pursue maximum profits. It's really important that we think about, you know, even though the patterns of housing displacement are so horrifying and deepening every day, it can't change if the structures that we have to protect people are not able to kind of push back against this idea that housing should primarily be something that lines people's pockets. And I think that through the review panel on financialization, I was able to learn more about what the issue of financialization looks like and feels like for people. Tenants from Herengate provided their testimony about, you know, losing access to community that they built over years and years, and thinking about, you know, the way that the buildings that they lived in were allowed to just kind of like deteriorate in order to then be considered for demolition so that luxury units could be built on that site. And learning in doing research on this topic that this is actually like a very lucrative tactic that corporate landlords use. It's sort of a playbook across the world, not just in Canada. And so these are really powerful patterns that we need to, as people who are kind of at the bottom of the pyramid, we really need to act together in solidarity, because that's the power that we have. If it's not necessarily in dollars, it is through relationships. And I think that's through the research I've done around lived experience and community building. The thing that I hear over and over and that I feel to be true in the very core of my being is that being together in solidarity, acting in the interests of your peers because our interests are bound up together, is so incredibly important now more than ever.
There's a lot of layers to what you just shared, Alex, and thank you for pointing that out. I wanted to underline the sort of inherent critique of this idea that the housing crisis is just sort of this natural phenomenon. It's a very important point that you raised. And yeah, of course, the book, The Tenant Class by Ricardo Tranjan, is definitely one for those of you listening to look at, because it also particularly speaks to the housing crisis or the crisis of access to housing in the Canadian context. And there's a lot of books about this focused more on the United States. And, you know, there is the reality of the sort of policy administrative dynamics that we have to face in this particular context and how to address these things together. Thank you for sharing your points on that, Alex. Just sort of deepening this on this particular point, can you just speak a little bit about any sort of, this could be just quick reflections on the ways that the media talks about this issue, because I think that, you know, it's sort of, there's a lot of, like, let's say, I would say, you do see quite a lot of reporting about individual families or people and sort of a personalized narrative, which obviously is important. And then you see a sort of broad policy talk, but there isn't sort of this breakdown of how huge investment capital is profiting from displacing people. And so I just want to zero in on this a bit more, because it's super important and you've looked into this.
Yeah, I want to bring it back to the point you raised about this kind of individualistic prioritization of home ownership on Indigenous territories and how these things are so deeply entrenched and at odds. I think that there's this real kind of dominant understanding that the sort of path in people's lives should be this aspiration to own property. And I think that a lot of responses to the housing crisis also prioritize this kind of very middle-class dream of everybody should be able to afford to own a home. And so a lot of resource goes into quote unquote expanding the middle class or making sure that people can afford to buy a home. That really creates a lot of distance between some of these kind of like structural underpinnings of how people's housing is destabilized or undermined. And I think that there really is this way that interpersonal conflict and tension, it takes up a lot of like space in order to create these conflicts between members of a community who actually have a lot more in common than they do different, and look towards each other and away from the people who actually hold a great deal of power to determine how our lives unfold. So there are, you know, a lot of corporations that are operating the majority of rental housing across the country, and are according to research undertaken by a colleague, Sarah Bueller at the University of Saskatchewan, corporate landlords and real estate investment trusts are responsible for the overwhelming majority of evictions, at least in the community where Sarah Bueller is working, but it's scalable to communities across the country. And so thinking about an issue as, you know, an individual landlord or an individual tenant, or kind of focusing in on how one person experiences crisis in the housing system, doesn't allow us to look at the full picture of how these things are actually patterns that reproduce themselves over time. And once we start to be able to put the pieces together to say, actually, this is a pattern, then we have a lot more power to be able to push back and create alternatives.
And, you know, it's an interesting point there that you focused on, which is alternatives and, you know, the underfunding of housing cooperatives in Canada in the mid-1990s is a clear example of the attack on actual alternatives. The Chrétien Martin governments in the 90s just decimated funding for cooperative housing, for example. So there's a long track record here of undercutting the use of public funds towards creating these alternatives. So there's, you know, this interesting moment where we're seeing a lot of tenant union organizing that addresses sort of some of the more like individual examples or even like neighborhood examples of the realities you've been talking about. But a lot of that organizing is happening with a broader analysis of combating, let's say, the broader sort of tendency towards financialization of housing and how that's interconnected with a lot of other systemic issues. People are hearing this interview either online or on community radio stations in Canada, which are also, you know, remaining infrastructure of, you know, community organizations that are alternative institutions, right? And it makes me think about the importance in this time to think about the importance of physical spaces as actual alternatives to these structures of power and economics that clearly are not benefiting the majority of people, and sort of thinking beyond this sort of distraction of a lot of the mainstream talking points. I mean, even the conservatives are talking about the housing crisis, but clearly they're not interested in building up alternatives, whether it's cooperatives or, you know, community radio or women's centers or public universities. You know, there's a lot of fueling of a recognition of a certain anger that exists today. But there's not a lot of actual addressing of what a collective public alternatives can be. And obviously that's complicated to address, but it sort of seems to be one of the questions that community organizers and activists really are in the place to start thinking through in a real way.
Yeah, I love that you connected these ideas of, you know, local radio and public spaces and spaces where people can come together, because I do think there is right now this process of defunding and sort of removing support for all of these spaces for, you know, the commons, the way that we can have third spaces or spaces where people can come together, but they don't necessarily have to be, you know, for profit. And I think, you know, I'm really moved by cooperative housing as an alternative model to the system that we currently have, and other ways that people can, you know, be in community and have housing security and take care of one another. All of these models of mutual aid and carving out space and protecting it for each other, I think, are really powerful ways that we can keep stories alive and tell the truth in a way that is really increasingly hard to do in the system that we have currently. And I think tenant unions are also really important and doing incredible organizing work to help make sure, you know, policies are pushed back against when they're going to cause harm to people's housing status, or to make sure that if there's, you know, a mass eviction, that there are ways that people are being organized in a way that, you know, is sometimes hard to do when you're facing eviction and you have all of these other things going on in your life. But to provide that energy and effort and support to make sure that, you know, you have this kind of future and space and community that can take care of you. I think it's really important. I'm doing some work with colleagues here in London to start an art hive as a way for people to come together specifically around issues of housing across the housing spectrum to create together, to do art together, and to just be in community and sit with each other, to break bread with each other. And so we're in the process of creating this space in response to this deep need to have places where people can just rest together and have access to leisure and joy, because those things are often the first things that are removed when we're facing insecurity or defunding. And so I think, as a researcher, a lesson I've learned from some of my peers and colleagues is to always look to ways that we can use the resources that we have for a collective good.
That was a conversation with Alex Nelson, a researcher based in London, Ontario, Western University, speaking about the dynamics of housing precarity and the housing crisis in Canada from a collective level, looking at some of the systemic issues and interconnections between housing injustice and how that is tied to other intersecting points of injustice in Canadian society. I think this is a set of important ideas that have been shared on this broadcast. I would encourage people to look up housingjustice.now online to learn more about some interconnected housing justice movements, some of which we've featured here on this program, including a zine that I recently edited, Voices for Housing Justice. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. I host and produce the program, and we air weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can learn more about the program by visiting soundcloud.com/freecityradio. That's also where the archives are. We're also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.
CFRC 101.9 FM is so thrilled to announce the launch of our brand new accessible website at cfrc.ca. Get your local news, stream your favorite shows, and stay up to date with upcoming events. You can share news tips, book a recording studio, request a PSA for airplay, and oh so much more. cfrc.ca was made possible through the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada and our amazing funding drive donors. Thank you so much.